So we'll try to play, I'll get through these as quickly as I can, bringing up the rear here to try to wrap some things together and give you a little bit of overview of how the subtlety of this evil has crept into our culture and what it's doing to us. First line. So the extent of the problem, you heard a little bit about how many people and percentages, and we're going to go over some of these numbers. And I always have the fascination of using the enemy's information in order to be able to quote their statistics. So the next 98 or 99 slides are from the Guttmacher Institute, and that'll bring us into the discussion. We should be out of here in time for 5:15 Mass, I think. But there are 62 million women, and they define childbearing age in the literature as between 15 and 44. We all know that there are some people that are younger than that and people that are older than that that are either conceiving or wanting to conceive. But roughly 43 million of those of reproductive age are sexually active, and they do not wish to conceive, but they have the ability because they have fertility. And we talked a little bit about infertility and subfertility. And unfortunately, the typical woman in the United States only wants to have two children. And so to achieve these two, she has the prospect of having to avoid pregnancy for over 30 years of her reproductive life. Next slide. So 98% of women between 15 and 44 who are sexually active have used at least one method of contraception at some point in time. And this is where they come up with the 98% number. They're not all at the same time. So if you look back over 30 or 35 years of managing fertility, at some point in time, if you look at sexually active women, they have used at least one method. And the 2% of NFP is a relatively generous estimate of the population, because if you look at some of the more recent statistics, it's down around 1% or even less than 1%. So if anything, the numbers have declined over the past couple of years. 62% of the population who currently use contraception, and 31% of them don't need it because they're either infertile, pregnant, postpartum, or trying to conceive. Actually, there are people that are abstinent, and there are some people that are virginal, believe it or not, and these are incorporated into those percentages. And then roughly 7% of those women in reproductive age are at risk of an unwanted pregnancy, and they're not using contraception. Next slide. So among the fertile sexually active females who do not wish to conceive, roughly around 89% of them are contracepting, and the majority of women are using reversible methods. Remaining males and females rely on sterilization, and roughly 37% of the population that are in the reproductive age have been sterilized. And that happens to be the dominant form of quote-unquote contraception. Under the age of 30, the pill is the leading method, and 35 and over, sterilization is the leading method. Sterilization is also the leading method among Black and Hispanic, part of the Margaret Sanger eugenic movement, and the location of the various clinics and institutions that are providing services to that population, and the recommendations that come from the healthcare providers in that population. And women who have less than a college education are a little bit more likely to be sterilized than not, especially if they're over the age of 35. But the staggering statistic is that 50% of all women between the ages of 40 and 44 have been sterilized. And so only 18% of males have actually been sterilized. Males somehow co-opt women into thinking that I'm not going to get that done, you need to get it done. And if you want it to match surgical procedures, the risk and the benefit of that particular procedure for a male is much easier as an outpatient under local anesthesia with fewer complications than it is for a female to have general anesthesia and some of the sterilization techniques that are available now. However, there are some newer sterilization techniques that are now coming out into the marketplace to be able to sterilize women up through the uterus. You saw the slides that Kyle showed earlier with a hysteroscope going up into the uterus, where there are a couple of springs that you can put inside the fallopian tube through a hysteroscope, and a particular mold of Teflon that you can shoot into the tube to block the tubes, and doctors will be able to provide that in the office without having to do general anesthesia. So there will be more and more women availing themselves of that. We only have about 7.5 million women who are using barrier methods, and we have 3 million plus teenagers who are using contraception. You kind of know this from the current discussion in the culture, but federal employees are guaranteed insurance coverage for contraception. I don't know if you knew that, but if you work for the federal government and you have their health insurance, you're guaranteed contraceptive coverage. We have 6.7 million women, 1.9 million teenagers who receive contraceptive services from publicly funded clinics. So that's not a problem with access. It's readily available. You can go into Walmart and they get a pack of hormonal contraceptive with a prescription for $6. And so it's not, and you walk into any Planned Parenthood, you can get it for free, and you can be 14 years old and you don't need parental consent. So they can walk in and get anything they want, IUD, anything they want, anytime they want, totally free. We already have 28 states that mandate insurance companies provide contraception. So it's more than half of the states already. So where the federal government comes out saying that we need to do this when we already have it in states where it's already been done is, you know, a sign of the direction they're going in. And the Affordable Care Act will mandate coverage for all contraceptives with no copays or deductibles from the person that's seeking the contraceptive. But we'll talk about the actual cost of that in a little bit. So all those statistics I told you are from the Guttmacher Institute. Unfortunately, the reality is that most Catholics, as has been alluded to, do not accept the church's teaching on contraception. Most of the women that are contracepting today grew up in a contraceptive culture. Pill came on the market in 1960, and so it's been around for 50-some years, and already a third of the Catholics, a few more than percentage than a third of the Catholics have been sterilized. The spiritual dimension of this, we know that we have a problem, and some of this has been alluded to. In the Old Testament, Exodus and Deuteronomy tell us that God promises blessings for people who have children, including no miscarriages, and to married couples who must always be open to God's plan for new life with every act of marital intimacy. So this is not something new. Romans tells us that sexual acts without the possibility of procreation are sinful. So there is biblical reference to this, and that self-giving love is life-giving love, or the love is a lie. And we talked about that fracture and that breaking up of life and love and babies and bonding. The unitive and the procreative elements of marital love can never be divided, or the marital love is divided and God is left out of the marriage. Ephesians tells us, and also Philippians, that mutilating the flesh, pharmakia, is a word that comes from the Greek, and these chemicals and products that people put in their body, including sterilization. When you think about when you're having a sterilization, you have perfectly normal, healthy fertility. You're walking into a healthcare provider's office and you say, I want to take my perfectly normal, healthy body and mutilate it and damage it and destroy it so that my biological function that God gave me doesn't work anymore for my convenience. And insurance companies pay for that. All sterilization procedures are covered by every insurance company, including Medicaid and Medicare. Now, the interesting thing is, well, why would you say that somebody on Medicare would need sterilization? And the answer is that there's such an abuse of that system that I have 35 and 40-year-old patients on permanent disability who are not necessarily disabled because they walk into my office and driving a nice car and nice clothing with nice jewelry and upright and walking and not in a wheelchair, not in a stretcher. And I look at the insurance form and they have Medicare and they're asking for a sterilization. And, of course, I deny them that, but in the meantime, the insurance companies do cover it. So this access issue is not an issue. Our catechism, next one. No, the other way. Next one. Our catechism tells us that periodic continence, and that was alluded to earlier, meaning the methods of birth regulation using self-observation of infertile periods is in conformity with the objective criteria of morality, whereas in contrast, every action with whether in anticipation of or in the development of its natural consequences, proposes whether as an end or a means to render procreation impossible, is intrinsically evil. Now, I know people don't like to use the word evil when they're talking to other people, but what it essentially says is that the very essence, the very nature, the very act of itself is an evil because it fractures the meaning of that act. God designated and designed what that act was for. And the fact that you would subvert the meaning and the end of that act means that you are bringing evil into that by separating what God has said cannot be separated. Next slide. So let all be convinced that human life and the duty of transmitting it are not limited by the horizons of this life only. Their true evaluation and significance can be understood only in reference to man's eternal destiny. And what this refers to is that God has a plan, and we don't know what God's plan is. We don't get to know what God's plan is. I can look back, and some of you have heard me tell the story that when Betty and I got married, we talked about having four children. And her first pregnancy was an ectopic pregnancy in the fallopian tube because she had endometriosis. Kyle was talking about her earlier and had damage to her tube. She had emergency surgery. So that was pregnancy number one and baby number one. We couldn't conceive for years. She went to a physician, had surgery, laparoscopy. This was in the 1970s, told that she wouldn't conceive. We should adopt. We adopted my oldest son. He's 38 years old, married. He's a physician with six children. Child number two. 2.5 years later, what the doctors know, my wife spontaneously conceived and carried full term and delivered my second son, who is here today with his children, and he and his wife are NFP instructors, and they have three children. Child number three. 2.5 years later, my wife conceived again, had another ectopic pregnancy, lost her second fallopian tube through emergency surgery, and at the age of 30, had no more fertility. Four children. God's plan. Not the way we wanted it, not the way we thought about it, but God's plan. When we look back and reflect on our lives, we would not give up the adoption and the experience that we had, as angry as we were, because my wife is the youngest of nine and we wanted to have kids. But we need to keep in mind that there is a plan that God has. And these children that we're preventing from being born and these children that we're aborting through abortifacients and surgical abortions all have a meaning and all have a part and a play in God's plan. You want to know where the people that are curing cancer, you want to know where the world leaders for peace are? We aborted them. 53 million strong in the since 1973, 4,000 every day. While we're sitting here today, a couple of thousand abortions have taken place and babies are being destroyed constantly. Next slide. This is a difficult teaching of the catechism in the church, and a lot of people don't like to hear this. But a child is not something that's owed to one. We've all heard that it's a gift. It's the supreme gift of a marriage, a human person. And a child may not be considered to be a piece of property. And when you heard Kyle speaking about IVF, we've objectified all of that the same way we've objectified women through pornography. So it's an idea, the idea that there is a right to a child is an incorrect idea. And in this area, only the child, because of the dignity of its creative nature, has genuine rights. It has the right to be the fruit of a specific act of conjugal love of the parents, and it has the right to be respected as a person from the moment of conception. It also has the right to have a mother and a father that's involved in this conjugal act. And so anything that breaks that unitive and procreative aspect as far as IVF-type procedures are concerned disrespects the dignity of the child, in addition to be intrinsically evil by fracturing that relationship or that bond that's supposed to be there. And you can see how all of these things, how do you get the sperm for the intrauterine insemination? Through masturbation. One sin just leads to another, just leads to another. It's the slippery slope that we've slid down for the last 30 or 40 years. The first IVF baby was in the 1970s. In England, and so we need to consider what we're doing and where we're going. Next slide. We talked about fecundity as being a gift. This is a slightly deeper word. I was an English major, and I think language means something. And so it's not just about fertility. It's about God's plan and his creative goodness. A lot of people don't like to hear, and a lot of people don't like to know, that the communion that a married couple experiences is very similar to Trinitarian love. The love that exists between the Father and the Son, and the love that exists between the Son and the Father, that they would give each other everything that leads to the existence of the third person of the Trinity, we get to experience as married couples in our conjugal intimate relationship. And when the Holy Spirit is present, the other part of the creed, at the bottom of the creed that Kyle was showing earlier, I believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life. And when a husband and a wife come together in that conjugal embrace and the Holy Spirit is present, a third person comes into existence for all of eternity, and it mirrors the kind of Trinitarian love that exists that we get to experience in our marriage vocations. And so we need to bring the sanctity and the sacredness of this intimacy back into our language when we're talking about to couples in pre-Cana and what Father Christie was talking about. The regulation of births represents one of the aspects of responsible fatherhood and motherhood, and legitimate intentions on part of the spouses, regardless. Breast cancer, people come to us all the time, well, doctor, you know, doctor, I have this, and what about this, and we can't do this, and we can't do that. There's nothing. Nothing. It's an easy answer. It's black and white, and no one wants to hear it. But there's nothing that justifies recourse to morally unacceptable means such as sterilization or contraception. It may sound harsh, and maybe I sound that way because that's the kind of tone of voice I have and the way I come across, and maybe some of that's just my passion. But the reality is that we can't go around trying to use the principle of double effect and all these other things to try to justify things. There is an answer. You can use natural family planning, and you can still choose, if you have to, in responsible parenthood, to never, ever conceive and still be intimate in relations. And if you're called to stop marital relations, and that's what God's plan is for you, then you find another way of being intimate. There are other ways of being intimate where people have physical disabilities where they're not able to engage in conjugal intimacy. So there's spiritual intimacy where people pray together. There's intellectual intimacy. There's emotional intimacy. There's communicative intimacy. And if you want to add spice to your life, then you add all of those things up and put them into your marriage. Next slide. So Humani Vitae, we heard a little bit about that before. This is another quote. But Pope Paul VI, he's amazing to me. And I've read through this encyclical at least a dozen times. And it was one of the first Catholic encyclicals that I had ever read when I went through my conversion back in 1999. But we must once again declare that the direct interruption of the generative process already begun, and above all, directly willed and procured abortion, even if it's for therapeutic reasons, are to be absolutely excluded as illicit means of regulating birth. Equally excluded is direct sterilization, whether perpetual or temporary. It means having a tubal ligation or a vasectomy, which is perpetual and permanent, or using one of the hormonal or IUD types of contraceptives, which is temporary, whether for the man or the woman. And similarly excluded is every action which would render procreation impossible. We cannot separate these two aspects. Thus, and Casti Canubi heard referred to in 1931 with Pius XI, thus, among the blessings of marriage, the child holds the first place. St. Augustine, the apostle himself, is therefore witness that marriage is for the sake of generation. And further, the procreation of new life is the right and privilege of the married state alone by the law of God and nature. This is 1931. If you don't think that God doesn't send us the appropriate men to lead our church and speak intelligently and passionately about what it is that we need to do, and remember that this was in response to the Anglican Lambeth Conference that said that they would allow contraception after 2,000 years of all the churches speaking out against it. Next slide. Further, in Casti Canubi, I won't read all of these, but the second paragraph, any use of matrimony exercised in such a way that the act is deliberately frustrated in its natural power to generate life is an offense against the law of God and nature, and those who indulge in such are branded with the guilt of grave sin. I don't think that you can get any more specific than that. Next slide. Donum Vitae, the encyclical from 1987 from John Paul II, when he's talking about science, and he was responding to some of the changes that were taking place with IVF and some of the newer scientific discoveries that were taken, it would be illusory to claim that scientific research and its applications are morally neutral. the inviolability of the innocent being's right to life from the moment of conception to natural death is a sign and requirement of the very inviolability of the person to whom the Creator has given the gift of life. When you were saying no to life, you were saying no to God, and you were saying no to His plan. Next slide. Life once conceived must be protected with the utmost care. Abortion, and it was mentioned that's taking place with Peter Singer up in Princeton and in Holland and other Scandinavian countries. Infanticide is now becoming more popular, are abominable crimes. And then the more merciful side of this is that the suffering of spouses who cannot have children, who are afraid of bringing a handicapped child into the world, is a suffering that everyone must understand and properly evaluate. And the one thing that we need to all consistently do over and over again with respect to this so that we understand this is to pray. Next. Evangelium Vitae, another encyclical from John Paul II. A new cultural climate is developing and taking hold, which gives crimes against life a new and, if possible, even more sinister character, giving rise to further grave concern. Broad sectors of public opinion justify certain crimes against life in the name of the rights of individual freedom. Where have you heard that before? And on this basis, they claim not only exemption from punishment, but even authorization by the state, so that these things can be done with total freedom and indeed with the free assistance of healthcare systems. This is 1995. This is not last month. Next slide. In familiaris consortio, the totality which is required by conjugal love also corresponds to the demands of responsible fertility. This fertility is directed to the generation of a human being, and so by its nature, it surpasses the purely biological order and involves a whole series of personal values. For the harmonious growth of these values, a persevering and unified contribution by both parents is necessary. And what does natural family planning do? It has you talking about your fertility. It has you talking about your signs. It has you discussing your fertile window, if you will. It has you discussing whether or not you're going to engage in the marital embrace or not, depending on where you are. People spend more time talking about the paper for their place cards for their wedding than they do about how many children they're going to have or what their plans for their children are. Next slide. As mentioned previously, and under the philosophical issues, God does not desire that married couples have unlimited numbers of children, but He does call couples to responsible parenthood. And as we mentioned, periodic continence using natural methods does not violate the dictates of God's plan for life and love. Interesting question. And this is more for an answer for women than it is for men, although not just to segregate it out, but as I mentioned earlier, that women take the responsibility, at least the majority of the time, for the contraceptive issues. If there's already a method of spacing births, it's 98 to 99% effective, and it conforms with God's plan of life and love, then why would you need other artificial means which do not and which may be harmful? And the most serious side effect of natural family planning is that when it fails, oops, you have a room full of people. We always get the story that, you know, little Johnny over here, that was a whoops. I said, no, it wasn't. It wasn't a whoops. You and your husband decided to engage in marital relations, and as a result, it was successful, and you conceived a child that was designed by God to be in this world. That was not an accident. Congratulations on little Johnny. You need to be able to have to go to the New England School of Comebacks and get a degree in order to be able to have these responses. Next slide. So, again, language. Ask people what the word means. Contra against, ception, life. It violates the nature of the conjugal act. It is anti-life. Contraception itself is not a sexual act. It's the act of willing. It's your desire. I want to use this hammer to hit that nail into the wall, but I don't want to have any damage to the head of the hammer. So I'm going to put something in between. I'm going to put a barrier in so that I don't damage the nail, so I don't put any marks on it or anything. And so you're trying to defy and you're willing against the possibility that something could actually come out of the reason why it was designed. Someone not engaging in sexual activity cannot contracept. So people say, well, aren't people using natural family planning doing the same thing? No baby, no baby. No, they're not engaging in intimacy. You are. They're saying, okay, we don't want to have life right now temporarily in our marriage for whatever reason. And the other interesting thing is the Catholic Church does not give us a list of criteria of what we are to use as far as the reasons why we choose our responsible parenthood. So what contraception is a willing that a life not exist, playing God. Next slide. So what makes the act of contraception itself is the will of the acting person, your belief or your intention or your choice, which renders the contraceptive behavior. And you can use NFP with a contraceptive intent or a contraceptive mentality. And that needs to be pointed out. And we tell all of the clients that we teach natural family planning to that even though it's natural and even though it's green and even though it's ecological and even though it has no side effects, that there is a moral and a spiritual aspect to this. It's a lifestyle. It's not just a method. It's not just a tool. And so that needs to be emphasized continuously. Medical implications. You heard some of these earlier, but one of the things I might mention of the reason, somebody asked a question about why doctors don't know about all this NAPRO technology, natural family planning. They can't get in to the mainstream journals in this country because they are owned lock, stock, and barrel by the pharmaceutical industry. Most of the articles that you see about any of this are in the British Medical Journal, the Scandinavian Medical Journal, international journals from other countries that leak into this country and that people latch on to. And when Joe Larimore and his group and Joe Stanford and Chris Callenport did a study, the only place they could get it published was in the Annals of Pharmacotherapy. How many physicians do you think read the Annals of Pharmacotherapy? It's mostly for pharmacists. And yet they did a study on the post-fertilization effects of emergency contraception in proving that it prevents implantation and that it is an abortive fashion. And this is in the literature. We also have some literature saying that all of these diseases that are listed here are relative contraindications, and yet they want to make the pill over-the-counter the way it is in Japan and in Germany, where women can just walk in anytime they want and buy it without the advice of a healthcare provider. Not that I'm advocating that, but people that have these diseases and they don't even know it, and they'd be walking in and buying these products. Next slide. The World Health Organization has developed guidelines for classifying the use of hormonal contraceptives in the face of chronic diseases, so even they speak to be careful who you're giving the pill to and keep it on low-risk patients. But in 1996, Lancet had a huge article. It's there. I put it up here so that you know the name of the journal. It's one of the biggest medical journals in this country. Most physicians get it. And a collaborative group on breast cancer looked at 54 epidemiologic studies and showed that there was an increased risk of breast cancer with pill use, especially if you use it before your first full-term pregnancy, and it increases by tenfold if you take the pill before the age of 20. Now, if you want to plot the use of hormonal contraception from 1960 to now, and you want to plot it on a graph with the increased incidence of breast cancer, and then you want to put it on the same graph with the increased incidence of divorce, they are parallel lines that have gone up from 1960 until now. Next slide. Health Magazine, 26% increase of breast cancer from hormonal contraceptives. Lancet in 2003, an increased risk of cervical cancer. Now, we all know that cervical cancer is caused by a virus called human papillomavirus. And we know that once you get it, you have it forever. And 99% of all cervical cancers are from HPV. But what's the relationship of the pill? Well, the most obvious one is that, well, people are more sexually promiscuous because of the pill, so they're having more frequent sex with more multiple partners, so they're more likely to get exposed to HPV. and there are over 35 high-risk strains of the virus. So the more partners you have, the more likely that you'll be exposed. And if you've had five partners and there's a 70% incidence of the infection in a population, well, then you got a 70% chance out of those five partners that you could have three or four different strains of high-risk HPV in your cervix by the time you're 25 years old, because that's kind of the average number of partners that 25-year-olds have these days. Five. That's average. That's not extreme. That's average. Because the average age of onset of sexual activity is about 17. But the other thing, remember when Kyle was talking about the mucus glands and he showed you a picture of the cervix and where the mucus glands come from so you can determine your own natural signs of fertility? Well, what does the pill do? It does the same thing that pregnancy does. It everts or turns inside out the squamocolumnar junction so that those mucus glands are damaged and exposed to the acidic effects of the vagina and all the bacteria and all the viruses in the vagina. And it's that transformation zone that the virus of HPV attacks, and that's where cancer happens. And if you smoke cigarettes, you increase your risk even more. And who smokes more than which sex smokes more cigarettes at almost any age? Women more than men, especially teenagers. World Health Organization, increased risk of cardiovascular events, increased risk of venous thromboembolic phenomenon or blood clots, increased risk of stroke, increased risk of heart attack, secondary to hypertension with the pill, Green Journal, 2001. Got it into a main journal. It's out there. Everybody ignored it. Two to six fold increase of blood clots with third generation progestins. They keep coming out with newer hormones all the time, and they're creating more and more problems. And the longer a woman takes hormonal contraception and the older she gets, the higher the risks are, especially for breast cancer. Next slide. These are just some studies. 44%, 42%, 50%, 10%, 40%. 18 of 20 studies that were reviewed by Chris Kallenborn in his book, Breast Cancer, Linked to Abortion and Birth Control, all show increased risks of breast cancer. Now tell me, if as a healthcare provider, if you walked into the office, let's say you wanted the pill, you were convinced that you wanted it, and you came in and you saw me, well, you're not going to get it, so you can forget that. But beyond that, which argument would I have better in dealing with? Well, you know, you really shouldn't be using the pill because it breaks the link between husband and wife and babies and bonding, and you're separating the procreative and unitive aspects, and it's intrinsically evil, and it really is a moral evil, and you're hurting yourself. Or would you rather hear, you know, this really increases your risk of breast cancer and heart attack and stroke and blood clots. Even if you're 18 years old, you really shouldn't be taking this. Here's some literature. Why don't you go home and think about it? And maybe, just maybe, they'll reconsider it. More than likely, they'll walk out of my office, never come back, and go to somebody else down the street and get their pill. They don't believe you. We need to get this information out. Next slide. There's a 24% increased risk of breast cancer for women taking the pill generally, currently taking the pill. There's a 58% increased risk if you've taken the pill for more than 5 years. And 144% increased risk if you're over the age of 45. And there are no studies on the pill in women over the age of 45, and most doctors are giving it to them. Zero. You want to talk about evidence-based medicine? There isn't any. There are no studies out there at all. Health Magazine looked at one of the largest groups of women between the ages of 30 and 49, 103,000 women in the Norwegian conference, and found these numbers. So you'll see variations depending on, again, the risk of the population. I mean, there are some people who have genetic predispositions to getting breast cancer, and the fact that they may be on the pill, the breast cancer may be more genetic than it is pill, but that's only 10% of the population. So how do the hormonal contraceptives work? Well, 96% of the time they prevent ovulation. You heard that mentioned, the anovulant pill. 2% of the time they interfere with sperm migration. And 1% of the time they prevent implantation. There's no way to actually prove that, but Larimore and Stanford did look at the post-fertilization effect. It does thin out the lining of the uterus, and we now have ultrasound measurements that document that there is definite thinning of the lining of the uterus. You need to have a thickness of the endometrium of at least 8 millimeters. for an appropriate implantation of a pregnancy. And the average thickness of the lining of the uterus on ultrasound is 6 millimeters of somebody that's on the pill. So it's considered by the fertility docs to be inadequate as far as implantation is concerned. Next slide. This was an interesting slide that I came across because it kind of summarizes, and we're going to put these slides on our website, pnfpn.org, but this is the World Health Organization showing the pill is an abortive fashion, and it's also a class 1 carcinogen. This is the World Health Organization. This is not a religious or spiritual organization. This is a highly secular organ. These are the people that airlifting condoms in Africa thinking that they're going to decrease AIDS. These are the people that advocating Depo-Provera shots going from village to village every 3 months to sterilize women temporarily. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So if you have HPV, the virus, and you use the pill, you increase your risk of cervical cancer 10% if it's less than 5 years, 30% if it's greater than 5 to 9 years, and over 150% if you use it for 10 years or more. The number one sexually transmitted disease is the HPV virus. Next slide. We see increases in prematurity and low birth weight. We see increases in multiple pregnancies with women who do ultimately get pregnant after the pill because you're suppressing your fertility and your natural system. We see an increase in infertility because of the STDs, and we have 19 million new cases of STDs every year, and 1 in 4 of them in teenagers, and how many times do you see that on the headlines of the front page of the newspaper? And at what cost? At what cost? Financially, economically, in our healthcare system, what cost 19 million cases of STDs every year? Most of them incurable. Next slide. Some new studies came out. The most recent one, there's a 5.9% loss of bone in the spine after 24 months of use, and you don't hear that very much in the literature. But the thing that the British Medical Journal did publish was a study showing that there was less mortality, meaning that you had less likelihood of dying among users of hormonal contraception. However, as Kyle mentioned, you have to look at the design because the study was a prospective cohort comparison that had weaknesses that can result in false findings. And it could have been that women who are more affluent and who are healthier decided to be the ones that took the pill, and so that they lived a longer life than women who are lower socioeconomic and had more diseases and couldn't afford the pill or didn't avail themselves of taking the pill. So all these confounding factors need to be taken into consideration before you actually just take the bottom line from a study. Next slide. So hypertension, blood clots, heart disease, stroke, liver tumors, gallbladder disease, death, 23 deaths with the patch by 2005. Class action suit, you see no more advertisements on the patch on the paper. It's still on the market. It's been black boxed and labeled by the FDA, warning, we didn't know you absorb 60% more of the hormones through your skin than you do when you swallow it. We didn't know that when we released the patch, and there have been 23 deaths that were documented up to 2005. I'm sure there are more, but there's a gag order now because of the class action suit against Ortho Pharmaceuticals relative to the patch, but they're still selling it, and it's still on the market. Breast cancer and cervical cancer we talked about. So what did John Paul II say about natural family planning? He said, natural family planning challenges us to respect the body of the spouses. He told us that it encourages tenderness between the spouses, that it favors an education of authentic freedom, that men and women will be free to know their bodies and free themselves up of the shackles that bind them in this breakdown of marriage and family, that it is an interior innate language that expresses the total reciprocal self-giving of a husband and wife, and it supports babies and bonding and life and love. And what did he say about contraception? It's an objectively contradictory language. It's not giving oneself totally the other. You can have me tonight, but you can't have my fertility. No, I'm going to use a barrier. No, I'm going to block. No, I'm going to destroy. No, I'm going to poison. No, I'm going to stop. And it leads to a positive refusal to be open to life, and it's a falsification of the inner truth of conjugal love. This is one of the reasons why we have such a high incidence of depression, because women actually innately know that this language is being broken and fractured in their innermost being. But their intellectual selves are saying, but you need to do this because Bill told me we can't have kids right now. He's got to finish his PhD, and we're going on this trip over here, and and you hear this all the time. We talked about some social implications, an increase in divorce rate from 5% in 1960 of marriages ended in divorce. We're now up over 50%, and the number of children affected is now over 1.2 million. We have 34% of children growing up in single-parent households not related to the death of one of the parents. So fully one-third of our young population are growing up without a mother or a father. And you heard Brian Gale talk 2 years ago about fatherless. He wrote his books that followed up with that with motherless, and now the most recent one released last year, childless, which is where we're heading, because people don't want to have children because we're overpopulating and they're a burden. They're not a gift. So the rise in divorce rate parallels the rise in hormonal contraceptive use. We have a 6 to 7 fold increase in the number of unmarried women who have given birth. And so the majority of births in certain ethnic populations, especially Afro-American, more than 60% of them are to single-parent mothers who are not married. We have an increase in child abuse and neglect. I'm sure all of you heard about the 3-year-old that was killed last week. 2-year-old that was killed last week by the biological parents that the court gave back, who were both drug users and abusers and had tortured this child from birth. They took the child away from the parents twice through the courts, and then finally some nice judge decided, oh no, the biological parents deserve to have this kid back, and 4 days later they killed the kid, 2 years old. You didn't hear the President of the United States come on the news and talk about that child and say, that child could have been my son, did you? But he spoke about the one in Florida. We have more deaths in Philadelphia. We're the murder capital of the world in Philadelphia, the United States in Philadelphia, with black-on-black crime, because there are no fathers in these homes in the lower socioeconomic groups. So we have an increase in violent juvenile crime. We have an increase in drug abuse. And we have a significant increase in suicide and depression. Now, the estimated annual medical cost for the treatment of STDs in the United States, in 1998, it was $8.39 billion from the Kaiser Foundation. Last year, from the CDC, it's now up to $17 billion that we're spending on STDs every year. In our healthcare system, they're talking about it being 1/6 of the GDP. They're talking about want to cut Medicare and save money. How about cutting STDs? How about abstinence programs and having these children learn what the morality and the meaning of the act is? And federal funding from taxpayers to Planned Parenthood for the 6-year period of 2002 to 2008 was $2.54 billion of your tax dollars for free access to contraception and abortion. They don't do mammograms. They're not doing breast cancer screening. They're doing breast exams, but they're not doing mammograms. And mammograms are not indicated in 18 and 24-year-olds, the age of the people that are going. 45 and 50-year-old women are not going into Planned Parenthood for their pap smears and their breast screening. It's teenagers and women in their 20s and 30s. Next slide. The cost for the pill. If on average it costs $50 a pack and you have to use it 12 months out of the year, you're spending about $600 a year. The estimates currently are that 12 million women are using the pill, so it's costing somebody $7.2 billion right now, and every insurance company pays for it. Couples who inadvertently conceive a child are likely to abort, so that has a cost, and abortion is the backup to contraception, because if you go into a relationship and you have sexual activity and your idea and your goal was to not have a child and the contraception doesn't work and you conceive, well, you still have the idea and the goal that you don't want to have a child, so you got to get rid of that child, so you kill it. So you can go get an abortion down on Comley Road, Northeast Philadelphia, without anesthesia for $400. If you want anesthesia, it's $550. But if you go into the hospital and a doctor does it in the hospital and you have to have blood work and have an anesthesiologist and use an OR and have an OBGYN do the abortion, well, then it's going to run between $2,000 and $3,000. So the cost to the insurance companies are now somewhere between $5.2 million and $2 billion for the surgical abortions that are being done. And again, somebody's paying for those. So this whole accessibility issue is not an issue, and the money's already being spent. Next slide. We talked at some of the psychological implications, but increased depression. I get these women coming in all the time, and maybe they'll see me. My partners are getting the pill, and they'll see me for something else like a bladder infection or a yeast infection or something like that. And they'll say, you know, they're 24 years old, and they'll say, you know, my libido's really down. And I go, like, well, you on the pill? Yeah. I said, well, that's why it's down. Well, what's that have to do with it? I said, well, I carry a package insert around with me. I said, well, first of all, it's in the package insert, so if you want to see it, you can just read it. So I try to keep it simple. And I said, but you are inducing a state of pseudo-pregnancy, and during pregnancy, your body doesn't desire or want to or need to get pregnant because you're already pregnant. And I said, and so you're suppressing your fertility, and you're suppressing the natural fluctuations that take place in your hormones throughout the cycle. And women are most desirous of wanting to engage in sexual activity when? Around the time of ovulation, when they're in the fertile window. Why? Because biologically God created it that way so that we could have procreation and we could fill the earth and be fruitful and multiply. So he made it that way. And so you're taking that away. You're taking that fluctuation and you're making it a flat line. My hormones are like this level every day, all the time. No ups and downs. Now, some people are being told and sold the bill of goods. Well, that's, you know, better because then I don't get moody and I don't get irritable. But the other thing is that you're in continued violation of natural law and in total disregard. And so there's the Ten Commandments. So there's a spiritual disruption. And there's a fracture of the relationship with God for which you were created to have relationship with and to, and for which this marital act is intended to mimic that communion, the analogy in the Bible between bridegroom and bride, between Christ and church, us. We're created for that. We're created for love. God decided to create us because out of love and for love and through love. And if everybody said, well, what's another word for God? And everybody said, well, love. But these people are not in love. They got it confused with another four-letter word from the father of lies, lust. And they're, no, the apple is good. Surely if you eat it, you'll be gods. And we're all trying to be gods. We're trying to control life and fertility and death. And as a result, women have decreased self-esteem. They're used as sex objects. And who are the objects of pornography? You don't see that many male pornographic sites. The majority of them are women. But those women are somebody's sister or somebody's daughter or somebody's mother or somebody's wife. But we don't see them. We just see past. We look through a veil and we can't see clearly. And so we need to be able to lift that veil with the truth of God's purpose for life and love. Next slide. We talked about divorce rates, and all of these were predictions of Pope Paul VI in Humanae Vitae. I had 60 copies out on the table out there. If anybody who hasn't read it and wanted to copy, you can get it for free on the website. But I printed up them in my office and brought them in. And now what we're identifying related to these post-abortive issues with women who have had abortions is post-traumatic stress disorder. I see women coming into my office in their early 50s in tears, depressed. And they say, oh, it must be menopause. I'm missing my period. I'm having hot flashes. My hormones are terrible, but I just can't function. And I look at their chart and I see they're a gravid of 4. That means they've had 4 pregnancies. They're a para 2. That means they had 2 full-term deliveries. And they've had 2 abortions. And I say, did you ever grieve your abortions? And they stop and they kind of like, grieve my abortions? No. I said, well, how old were you when you had your first abortion? Well, the first one, I was 17. I was a senior in high school. I was on the volleyball team. My parents took me to Planned Parenthood. An abortion. Then I was in college. I got pregnant again in my junior year. And I had a boyfriend. I thought we were going to get married. I never told my parents about that one. And I got married when I was 25. And we had our 2 kids. And I had my tubes tied. And that's kind of the general story. And I said, well, they were your children. Then they start crying. And then you engage them. And that office visit doesn't take 15 minutes. But these women have never grieved these children and these losses. And they know in their heart of hearts, they know what they have done. I am an adopted child. In 1948, yeah, you can do the math, I'm 63, just like Monsignor Bransfield said. In 1948, a 21-year-old woman who conceived me said yes to adoption, and here I am today. God's plan. She could have said no. She could have said no, and then that he would have married somebody else that was of more even temperament. Next slide. Almost done. I know we kept you over, but I'm almost done. So we are wounded by the culture of death, and we are crying out. And all you need to do, Benny, hand me the picture that's in the front of that. It's in a plastic thing, right in the front of the folder. For those of you who haven't seen this statue, this is a statue of the wounded Christ, beaten, bloodied, and battered. This is how we are, suffering, weeping, and wailing. And we need to be brought to the resurrection. We need to be brought through the truth. This is not what it was intended to be. And so I would ask you to take a look at what's going on and learn. You know, we talked about the divorce rate, less stable families, teen promiscuity, easy abortion. It's legal in the United States. We legalize killing our children. What's next? We've devalued womanhood and motherhood, and we all are in an area of isolation, and we feel selfish and self-centered. Next slide. So we have these depressive symptoms that arise from this sense of dehumanization. We treat fertility as a disease. We've depersonalized sexuality. It's now genitocentric. It's not cerebrocentric. You don't think with your brain. You think with your genitals. And so that's what reacts. It's no longer sacred. And we are suffering, as Rick Fitzgibbon says, from a dissociative disorder where we insulate the executive self from the effects of the abuse. We're self-abusing, and we just have isolated ourselves and moved like, no, that's not happening to me. This is what I need to do. And so even in the Institute of Psychiatric Services, as early as 2000, Sweeney has talked about this post-traumatic stress disorder that women are suffering. So everything passes by way of the family, and we need to get back to that. That is the building block. The Catholic Church teaches the principle of subsidiarity. Everything is organized in order to the smallest unit that is successful. What was the first successful unit that God created in the beginning of creation on that day six? The family, a husband and a wife, a man and a woman who come together and the two become one and to be fruitful and multiply. And where are we now? We see all kind of caricatures of family, and we see attempts to want to redefine the word family and redefine the word marriage and redefine these definitions that have been with us since the beginning of time. Modern technology through the internet, and we talked a little bit about pornography, can extend the forces of evil throughout the world at an alarming rate. I would challenge you. Modern technology can also spread the truth throughout the world at an alarming rate. So find out what the truth is. Start a blog on NFP. Start a blog on marriage. Start a blog on families. Write, pontificate, teach, quote, put articles, put homilies from YouTube, make your own YouTube video. Do whatever it is and whatever it takes to get the word out there. It's time to end the culture of death and convert to a culture of life and love. Education is the key. I know we're starting out at a very low point, and we need to have to start with basics. But most of you, if not all of you, are educators, and you've all been educated, which is why you're here. So you know something about education. And so your job as part of the evangelization is to not only live the life of Christ, but to go out into the world and portray it and show it and share it and give it to everybody, especially your children. Especially your children. They're the your parents are the primary educators of their children. Healthcare providers, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves. I heard Kyle mention there's like 50, maybe 100 NFP-only OBGYNs in the country. The Catholic Medical Association has a total of 1,600 members. In 1967, they had 10,000 members. What happened in 1968? Humanae Vitae. And what happened to the rest of them? They turned around and said, I can't accept that. I can't do that. I can't go out. That's not medicine. That's not healthcare. I can't do that. And they haven't come back. And we are fighting an uphill battle to come back. We've grown from 500 to 1,600 in the last 10 years. But 1,600 is a drop in the bucket. We have an American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. There's 200 that belong to that group. You have 50, 60, 70, 80 NAPRO-trained doctors in the country. Everybody ought to be trained, and it ought to be in our Catholic medical schools at least. At least. I get emails all the time from residents, do you know an authentically Catholic OBGYN residency that I can go to? There's a handful. You go to Georgetown, it's a Catholic university, and the president went there, they covered up the cross, and blah, blah, blah. But they have a clinic, and in their clinic they give out contraception. But it's not on the campus of the school and the hospital. It's kind of out in the bad neighborhood. And so their residents go down there, and they don't teach NFP. So it's not authentically Catholic. So we have a committee now that is coming together and starting to meet to try to put together the first authentically Catholic medical school in the United States. And the hope will be that if it happens, that we can put it together with Steubenville and Franciscan University. And it's just in the grassroots, but there was a meeting in Washington, D.C. First meeting occurred this year, the day before the March for Life in January. There'll be another meeting coming up. We have the mid-year meeting from the Catholic Medical Association in June, and so that will be an ongoing discussion. But fertility is not a disease, and healthcare providers are the key. You know, women can't get an IUD, and they can't get birth control pills, and they can't get a sterilization unless they go to a doctor or a healthcare provider. They can't walk into the drugstore and get it yet. Yes, they can get the morning after pill if they're over 17. They can get an abortion, they can get the pill. But the reality is that they need a healthcare provider to give them a prescription. So it starts, challenge your doctor. You women go into, you all support some OBGYN somewhere. All of you go for checkups and exams and pap smears and everything. If your doctor is not, you know, non-contracepting or NFP only, I'm not telling you to come to me. I'm just telling you, challenge them. Give them a brochure. Give them a pamphlet. Tell them you're wrong. Show them the article. Show them the literature. Maybe they didn't see the article in Lancet. Maybe they missed the one in the Health magazine. Maybe they didn't do the research and look at it. Next slide. So truths about condom. I said this last year at a conference in Cherry Hill. A condemnation equals condemnation. And that's where we're headed. There is a moral reality to this. It's just not about economics. It's not about sociology. It's not about psychology. This is about your eternal soul. We're all called to holiness, and we're all here for the same reason. We're supposed to be helping each other get to heaven and allowing these children to do this. It's intrinsically evil. It's destroying their health and their life and their family, and they're our children that are doing it. I'm nearby in tears to think that one of my children may not be in heaven with me someday, because he and his wife decided to contracept or whatever they decided to do. And the last slide. Our popes have been put here along with our bishops and our priests. And Paul VI said, if you desire peace, seek justice. And then John Paul followed him up and said, well, if you desire justice, seek chastity. So I'm sorry I kept you over. However, I would like to take this opportunity to thank everybody that stayed and that participated and attended and supported us in our 10th anniversary year. And I would like to thank all the catering people. And there is a meeting that is going to happen in about 15 minutes. from a collaborative group of people that are going together to get together with some people from St. Peter's Hospital and the Pro-Life Union and fertility care practitioners, and see whether or not we can bring some sort of entity to the Philadelphia area that will help combat and provide women with authentic women's health care through NAPRO technology and NFP training, as well as really good medical care. And I think that there's a drawing for a basket that... And the winner is Mary McCrossin. Is she still here? Oh, George wants me to tell you about the Philadelphia Natural Family Planning Network, but I assume that you knew about that. And that's why you were here and supporting us. And thank you for supporting us and everything that you've done. And let's close with a prayer real quick before we leave, because we have